It's a great honor and certainly a great pleasure to be here. This is an important conference, and I will confess immediately that vulnerable children are not on my agenda most of the time. So I'm glad that we have a panel on whose agenda it is most of the time. I'd like to acknowledge and thank Ruth for inviting me. I'm very sorry, Ruth, that you're not here, but remembering that line from Listen with Mother, I hope you are now sitting comfortably. And I'd certainly like to thank Justin Curtis, who is somewhere in the room, and Jason for all of the wonderful attention they gave to my travel. Vancouver is rather a long way away. It's, in case you don't know, 445 miles from east to west of Canada, and then it's a few more miles before you get here. Safeguarding vulnerable children and adults is a subject of global interest, and a recent editorial in The Lancet on economic austerity, food poverty, and health in the UK was, for me, very distressing. It was an editorial which appeared 2 weeks ago, and I recommend it to you if you didn't see it. The risk to which vulnerable children and adults are subjected has been documented repeatedly over my lifetime. I don't know about yours. And society's responses to the cartload of reports on this subject scarcely merits a passing grade. In fact, I would mostly give them failing grades. In my city of Vancouver, on the west coast of Canada, we have at least 1,600 homeless people in a population of 500,000. British Columbia has the highest child poverty rate in Canada, with one in five children considered statistically poor. An estimated 1.2 Canadian children are affected by mental illness, and only one in four receives appropriate treatment. Our countries share many cultural similarities. So the meta-narrative for my talk today concerns three pillars of care as I see them: quality, safety, planning. And threaded through these pillars are the complicated and complex topics of communication, of which we've heard something already, and collaboration, of which we will now hear a lot more. In a moment, I'd like to illustrate these matters with a story, but first of all, I'd like to share with you some general observations which have occurred to me over the last 47 years of doing all kinds of things academic. A major problem confronts us when we consider the challenges for working across health and social care boundaries. And I should say that the North American lexicon is human services, but today I will say social care to be on the right side. The problem is that there are many occupational interpretations of what on the surface look to be an identical issue. So, for example, what one group may find a cause for diagnostic testing may be for another group a cause for family counseling, and for another group for putting somebody in jail. And occupational interpretations may themselves mask a root cause. So this problem of occupational interpretations, for me, illustrates an urgent need to develop evidence-based, collaborative practice so that those interpretations of a particular problem are all of the same kind and not at each other's heads. More than 10 years ago, Wim Duisenberg was president of the European Central Bank. At that time, there was much discussion about interest rates in the EU, as there is today, and I noticed that our Mr. Carney is trying to fix the problem for the UK. As president of the Central Bank, Mr. Duisenberg was responsible for decisions about interest rate changes, which he was frequently pressed to raise. And in response to this pressure, he is reported to have said, and I don't think it's apocryphal, reported to have said, "I hear you, but I don't listen. I hear you, but I don't listen." How many times during interactions with patients, clients, customers, and another word I learned this morning, service users, do we hear but not listen? Without both perceptively hearing and listening, and they're not both the same thing, how can we possibly reduce risk? How can we possibly control risk in order to prevent those adverse events which you and I know only too well? You have had your multiple reports. Remember the Bristol inquiry. The United States has had the Institute of Medicine report, To Err is Human. And in Canada, we have had our adverse events report. So it's clear to me that a better understanding of terms like vulnerability and resilience can only come by listening to and understanding those who are both vulnerable and have very low resilience. Listening to them and then understanding. By its very nature, health and social care workforce is a very complex system. It includes regulated and unregulated health and social care professionals, occupations, and it's often been considered to be the most highly educated workforce in the world, which on the one hand is great. We do want highly educated individuals who are caring for us, but on the other hand is terrible. Sorry, that's the economic piece. It's terrible because there are egos associated with this space and this space. So this highly educated workforce has an upside and a downside, and one with which we're constantly grappling. And it is also torqued by language, by gender, and by perceptions. And perceptions that come from many different places. So if we are going to improve collaboration, and therefore the planning of care, we clearly need to provide our students in training with a far richer understanding of occupational roles and responsibilities across the entire health and social care continuum. And let me just add a note which I did not have in my notes, which is I consider the police, the fire, and the ambulance folks to be an integral part of the kind of work that we do in British Columbia. The aging population is engaging more and more of our attention. We know that vulnerable adults are frequently subjective to ageism and abuse. Understanding aging tests every tenet of quality, safety, and planning in our systems, your system as well as our system. And it also tests every approach that we have to communication, because 70, 80, and 90-year-olds don't use technology. I tweet, but I'm not quite 90 yet. And I Twitter, and I blog, and I do all those other things. But the majority of our population has nothing to do with that. So really, when we think about the 20 or 30-something health or social care professional, we have to realize that they are decades removed from the creaks of old age. And that what might work with individuals of their own age does not necessarily work with their grandparents. Ageism so easily creeps in. The febrile and frustrating presence of Shakespeare's seventh age, we will all get there, God willing, is all too often an invitation to abuse. And I know that some of you will be talking about that today. And it takes a determined government to ensure that those abuses are held in check. One of those abuses is well known to all of us. It's, well, he's 90 years old, and he's had a good life, as though that exempts us from providing the best quality care we can across the entire lifespan until the will and the soul disappear. I'm reminded of the story of the young man who asked his grandfather, "Grandpa, what man would want to live to 90? To which his grandpa said, "The one who's 89. The grandson was my grandson, and the grandpa was me. So protecting vulnerable adults from the worst excesses of society calls for understanding collaboration. And that's very, very hard. And understanding it across a large number of health and social care professionals. There isn't an easy option, and I was delighted to hear the comments of the panel this morning. Oh, and incidentally, I've tried to keep this slide both gender and culture free. On the left-hand side, we have the United States of America. And on the right-hand side, of course, this is your dear country. So let me pass to my true story. This story is meant to illustrate the pillars of care, cross-cutting themes, and where they went seriously wrong. And I'll move from this brief description to a discussion of the issues that are threaded through this story. So I will not refer directly, necessarily, to this man, but this is the basis on which I've based my comments. Mr. X was 91 years old. He lived together with his wife independently in their own home in Vancouver. On a late November day, which in Vancouver means we're in the monsoon season and it's pouring with rain at 10 o'clock at night, following dinner in a restaurant after his birthday, he tripped and fell over a curb. Within hours, he'd received surgery for a broken left hip. At night, on the recovery ward, he fell whilst getting out of bed, confused and disoriented from the anesthetic. And I think we should understand that we still are not clear about dosage, anesthetic dosage, in the elder population. So this is not an unusual event. All right? As a consequence of that fall, he broke his right hip and his right arm. You say, who didn't put the bed rails up? However, those injuries weren't discovered till 10 o'clock the next morning. He received further surgery, and 3 days later, he died. The case of Mr. X was referred to the Patient Care Quality Review Boards of British Columbia by his children, who served as complainants about the care their father had received in hospital, or rather, as I like to think about it, the care he hadn't received. The Patient Care Quality Review Boards, of which I'm a member, were established by Act of the Provincial Parliament. That's like something going through Westminster here, I suppose, because we don't have any provincial legislatures in England. Members of the board are appointed by the Minister of Health, so I'm appointed by the Minister of Health, and report our findings and recommendations directly to the minister. The minister actually sees what we report. And then the minister sends those recommendations on to the offending health board, where the complaint is coming from, and the health board is intended to shape up and attend to what we've said. And incidentally, it's very interesting that over 4 years, I would say about 92% of those recommendations have been attended to. But time after time after time after time, the major complaint that is heard by the board has to do with communication breakdown. Time after time. In the case of Mr. X, the board noted the importance of listening attentively to family members. To family members. Not to the other professionals. And the thorough sharing of information between health and social care professionals, patients, and members of the family. The board noted that listening is especially important in cases where you have multiple health professionals and multiple program areas that are involved in the patient's care, which is not unusual when you're working with somebody who has a chronic health problem. We used to say chronic disease, we now talk about chronic health. So the board recommended, first, that all health professionals involved in care are made aware of the importance of listening. You would think, don't they do that already? No, they don't. And also, that they listen to the other members of other programs that are involved in patient care. And I was very interested to hear this morning, the board recommended that appropriate clinical information is shared and understood by those who were receiving care and their providers. Although in our case, we were much more concerned about the individual who was receiving care getting information than we were of the family members, well, that's equally important, because quite often, a person receiving care is in no space, place, or time to actually respond in a very suitable way to what it is that's being recommended. So, thinking about this case, what then have we come to understand? We've come to understand that communication does not equal information transfer. Information is about data. It's about numbers. It's about events. It's about actions. It's about decisions and other quantifiable activities. Communication is how we interpret and talk about that data and how it's received and understood by the listener. Talking, listening. And there are always two people involved in this activity. Clearly, and again, we heard this morning, clearly the correct transfer of information is of critical importance for quality care. Communication breaks down because information is transmitted inappropriately. It's transmitted incorrectly. And sometimes it's not transmitted at all. Think about the number of times that you've had to deal with these kinds of entities. Inappropriate, not at all, or incorrectly. In our highly specialized health and social care systems, each professional group has developed acronyms. I heard a few this morning. Some acronyms are transparent to both the profession and to other professions, but many, many acronyms are opaque, frequently not understood, and sometimes misused. Think about it. How many times do you hear an acronym and you don't know what it means, but you don't put up your hand and say, what the hell are you talking about? Acronish, as I call it, is the plague of good information transfer. I'm going to write a book called The Death of the Healthcare System, Acronish. Telling a story is first about listening, something that doesn't come easily to busy healthcare and social care professionals, because a lot of the time we're looking for diagnostic information and you want to get there. And forgive me if I name the undergraduate medical students that we have in problem-based learning, but by golly, the faster we can get there, the happier they are, and there's not much listening goes on. So good listening and clear talking are preeminent skills in a health and social care professional. They need very careful training. But how often do we include this in our training, in our educational programs? I think what we do is simply assume that everybody's born talking. Well, most people are born talking, and because they're born talking, they must be a good listener. We just assume this. No, it's not like that. It's only when we've listened carefully to the story being told that we can press for information to clarify points that are made in the discourse. Quite often, health and human service professionals, social care professionals, are listening and then they go right past an important piece of information that is critical to understanding what it is that's going on with the patient. So we need to understand and to comprehend what it is we've heard. And in order to comprehend, we need time to reflect. Reflect on what we've heard so that we can be absolutely sure that we understand what was heard. And again, think of the number of times when this kind of goes by you and then after the patient, client, customer, service user has left the room, you say, oh, golly, I should have asked that question, all right? That moment of reflection gives you an opportunity. Then we have to respond in an articulate and clear way so that the patient or client who's telling the story understands that we, as listener, have understood what they've said. We've looked at our students with clients. We have fake clients, of course, just like you do. And by golly, they will go at it thinking that they're getting all of this information out of the patient who is acting as our surrogate. And what we realize as time passes, they just don't understand what it is the patient's saying. They're not testing to make sure that what the patient is telling them is what it is they're scribbling down in their notes. They're not testing to ensure that the patient understands what it is that they're saying. So what I want to do is to kind of flip the process to us as the storyteller, as the health and social care professional, as the storyteller. So we have the patient, the storyteller, then we have... When we tell our story, remember now, we're loaded with data. We got lots of information that we're going to have to tell the patient or client. And when we tell that story about what we think might be done to help them, we have to listen to what we say. We have to listen to what we say. You know, it's this third ear. It's coming out here. We better be monitoring it here. And then we have to check with the patient or client to ensure that she or he understands, comprehends what it is that we said. You see this kind of... I mean, if you're being told some not very good news about having to lie in bed for 3 weeks, this is not nice. And you don't get this sense of they don't really understand what it... You've got to check that, because that's a key to the collaboration between you and the patient. And we have to give them a chance to respond in a way that gives us assurance that they have indeed understood what it is that we have been telling them. And then we need to check again, and we need to go through this interlocution all the time. And it's this point, or it's this series of points, that we've kind of analyzed out of all of the cases that we've been hearing where communication breakdown is involved in the complaints that the system receives. And I would put to you that it's high time, no, it's past time, that we put the story into our curricula. There is no program at my university that does this. It's unbelievable. I know we're out there on the edge of the universe and we should know better, but we don't do it. We don't spend time talking about talking and listening, listening and talking. And if this lesson is real, and I believe it is, then we have to make a mighty big jump to getting this into the curriculum. You just don't understand Women and Men in Conversation. Anybody ever read that book? Okay. It's a 1990s nonfiction book about language and gender by Deborah Tannen, who is a professor of social linguistics at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. And it was on the New York bestseller seller list for 4 years, and I'm sure that Deborah made a pile of money out of it. But it's a good book, and I recommend it. There are lots of social linguists who have some arguments with it, but here's what she says. For most women, and this came out in some of the discussion this morning, in most women, the language of conversation is primarily a language of rapport. It's a way of establishing connections and negotiating relationships. For most men, talk is primarily about, and I'll bet you can guess it, preserving independence, negotiating and maintaining status, and the hierarchical social order. There are these clear differences. My wife was a social linguist for all of her academic life. My wife and I, many, many years ago, when I was young, naive, and didn't know any better and shouldn't ask a question, was asking her something and said, oh, I think we should do, and I think it was to go to somewhere or another. And she said, okay, I'll think about it. I said, great, okay. I said, I will think about it. I said, well, doesn't that mean we're going to go? She said, no, I said, we'll think about it. she was negotiating, and I was assuming. And if this goes on in my relationship, imagine what goes on in other people's relationships where there isn't a social linguist. It was a big learning piece in my life. You cannot make that assumption of aha, meaning yes, I agree. Now in Canada, I don't know about here, but I suspect it's exactly the same. Approximately 80% of the health and social care workforce is female. 80%, it's maybe 81%. Yet, we've not given much, if any, thought in our educational programs to the matter of gender differences in both language use and language understanding. Weird, very weird. It cannot be any coincidence that breakdown in team-based care is frequently a function of language of rapport being at cross purposes with a language of independence, negotiation, and status. And if you have worked in acute, you will understand that I'm referring to. In the past 25 years, we've learned much interesting and useful information about safety from the airline industry. Some of that information has come in the shape of checklists, and some of it has come through an understanding of crew resource management. And there's a big debate at the present time about checklists in, for example, the ER or the OR, and probably in other areas of health social care. Big debate. Because the airline is not like the complexity of, well, it's complex, but it's not like the health and social care. Today in health and social care, it's hard to know whether we've seen a diminution in adverse events, particularly in Emerge and the operating room, through introduction of checklists and crew resource management. I know, as I said, there's a big debate about it, and I wish there was more work on crew resource management because it's incredibly interesting what that does for esprit de corps within the group that fly within that flying Seaguar, you know, every day. One of the most interesting illustrations of effective communication from the airline industry can be found in an amazing incident which occurred on January the 15th, 2009, when an Airbus 320 lost power when taking off from an airport in New York. Some of you will remember it. This particular communication can be heard somewhere on YouTube. It always makes my hair stand on end. The captain was Sully Sullenberger, and it just so happened that he is a safety expert, and he'd been a glider pilot for much of his life. Two significant factors. The plane had taken off, piloted by the first officer. I believe this is always the case, because I check. The captain does the takeoff, and the pilot does the landing, and the first officer does the takeoff. You can recall that Canadian geese, so help me, flew into the engines and forced a shutdown. And that, of course, needed a safe landing site. So the communication between captain and first officer in this instance was vital to the safety of passengers and crew, and that's what you will hear if you actually find it on YouTube. But after much transmission between various control towers, it's clear that there's no airport near enough for this plane to land, and heroic measures are called for. What you hear is Captain Sullenberger saying, "My aircraft." First Officer Skillings responds, "Your aircraft." He's still in contact with the control tower, but ultimately Sullenberger says, "Can't do it, we're gonna be in the Hudson." Does that, you know, it makes my hair stand on it. Every one of the people on that plane came out alive. You can see them all standing on the wings there. The pilot's motto is aviate, navigate, communicate. Clear, concise, directed communication saves lives. Think about it. So let's now turn to the problem of collaboration, which is clearly a complex challenge. It's a complex challenge because in health and social care, the health and social care professionals frequently come from very different models and methods of practice. Think, for example, of the difference between the method of practice of a cardiologist and a social worker. And then ask yourselves how often you've heard those uncollaborative words, "Oh, that's the medical model." So, when we're challenged with working collaboratively together, we clearly have to cross boundaries. And some of those boundaries are pretty high. And often the boundaries represent competing domains. For a moment, think about some personal domains which get in the way of collaboration. We, all of us, because we're human, have fear of change. Being challenged to work in a different mode will always occasion hesitation and not often a little anxiety. We frequently have misunderstanding about other health and social care professionals, which was mentioned this morning, about what they learned, about what they practice, and how they are regulated and legislated. Before I retired from UBC, I did a survey. We have 15 health human service programs at my university. I did a survey of, it was random, but I did balance for gender. Survey of the graduating students, the students who would be graduating to enter practice. So they were in their final year and almost their final month. And my survey was very simple. It was, how many other health or human service professionals did you meet during your training? Zero. Crazy. We're frequently confronted with differences in power, income, and social status that accrue to particular professions. I need name none. We know that there's gender discrimination and inequality in the health and social care workforce. We need a lot more work to bring that to the foreground. And these competing domains are compounded by professional gender and language usage. And cross-cutting, because there's always a cross-cut, cross-cutting these personal domains are the institutional ones, which are seen in models of practice, organizational structures, whether they're vertical or horizontal, depending on the organizational whim of the day, and the managerial priorities with respect to funding. And time after time after time after time, you know, you will hear complaints from one or another. How come they spend so much money over there and they don't spend any money over here? Institutional priorities with respect to funding is a huge competing domain for many, many of the health social care professions. Health and social care education is a Byzantine labyrinth of many silos, each program living in its own space, each with its own professional practices, and of course, expectations. It's very hard to work together if you don't spend some of the time learning together. Duh. The emergence of this mode of education over the past 100 or so years owes much to, in the UK, the Medical Reform Act of 1858, which was passed in order to improve medical education and curb quackery. And in the United States, of Abraham Flexner's very famous report to the Carnegie Foundation in 1910, both of these very, very influential reports of the medical profession set up conditions for education in medicine that served as role models for virtually all of the emerging health human service programs in the 20th century. Essentially, the two major pieces of work called on medicine to enact higher admission, graduation standards, adhere strictly to protocols of mainstream science in teaching and research, and to bring all of those people concerned with education into the university sector. Think of your own professions over the past 100 years and their attempts to bring that learning inside the university. Being a huge and hugely important impetus, very important for public health, very important for population health, but has had this siloing effect. Clearly, collaboration means commitment. I view this commitment in terms of action items and behavioral items. And we've learned from an enormous number of studies, both in business and the professions, that these items are key to successful collaboration. And although I've numbered them from 1 to 4, because I didn't want to put in more dots, they are all, in fact, equally important. If we are going to act on the commitment to collaboration, then clearly we need shared values, shared goals that are placed on clear objectives. How often do you find them? It never ceases to surprise me that we don't follow agreed protocols. And I was very interested to hear that this morning, you know, where we actually develop protocols and then somehow or another they kind of disappear into a closet and we're just having our meeting and yes, it's all over now. So these fundamental precepts aren't followed. Informed feedback is good, not only for our professional working and professional development, but also for ensuring that the right care pathway is being followed and observed. And one of the things that we noticed, and we are noticing as we listen to cases from across my province, is the feedback is terrible. So why are we surprised that the care pathway gets forgotten? We all know that the two major areas for adverse events are shift change. You know, I learned from one of our hospitals that at shift change, they actually take the patients in alphabetical order. What if the most, you know, severe case has a last name that begins with Z? Tough luck, you know. So we're making some fundamental changes to say, you know, no, we take them in order of severity when we do the shift change. But for years and years and years, it was always done by alphabetical order. So feedback is good, if only to get the care pathway right. And effective collaboration, again, requires that we have time to review progress and to reflect on its efficacy. And sometimes it's not the time that you are doing this reviewing process that you want to do that. You want to go away and come back. We have data now to show you come, go away, come back with the same issues in front of you and say, yeah, this is what we've heard. We know that regular, honest communication builds respect and trust. And again, ask yourself, how much regular communication do you have with members of your team? That understanding and respecting the complementary roles played by each and every member of the team is essential. Again, something which was mentioned earlier this morning. And we're deeply aware that each and every team member has to know how to handle his or her emotions. And I don't know if you've ever been to a team where this is clearly a problem with one team member. And then when this happens, how do you manage the conflict that goes along with it? We've got to learn that. And these action items, these behavioral items, have to be in the curricula. And we don't do it. Oh yeah, I will have, and forgive me nursing, but I will have the director of nursing say, John, we actually do all this in our program. I say, yeah, do you do it just with nurses? He said, well, yes. I said, but you know, there are other people out there who work with you who are not nurses. Oh yeah. I said, how about we do something a little different. So, in my view, we urgently need to build our educational models around interprofessional education. And this means recognizing that classroom learning does not equal workplace practice. I mean, I can do pop health, I can do public health, I can do determinants of health in very large multidisciplinary classes. But if you want the reality of a chronic disease, let's take diabetes because it's so easy, ha ha, the place to learn interprofessional collaborative practices in the diabetic clinic as a team of students. It's the only way to do it. This classroom is far too removed. Interprofessional collaboration has to be taught and learned in that setting. And it's not achieved by some miracle. We don't have any miracles for doing this, as far as I know, and certainly it won't happen waving Harry Potter's magic wand. The culture of interprofessional collaboration has to be built strategically, and that means every day. It's not something you do on Friday afternoons. at 3:30 because it's raining and he can't go for beer yet. It has to be done every day. It has to be done with every patient, client, customer, etc. And it has to be done with every care provider, be they professional, family, or the equivalent of the family. It is tough, but we have to do it. Our education and practice needs to be built around interprofessional collaboration. Perhaps above all, we need to be serious about reforming the culture in which we work. Some of you are perhaps old enough to remember, maybe not, Mrs. Do As You Would Be Done By, from the Water Babies. I see no way of safeguarding vulnerable children and adults until we do reform the culture. At the end of the day, the culture of care must be the safeguard. We need to constantly remind ourselves of the golden rule that one should treat others as one would like them to treat oneself. And that means you do not speak pejoratively of other professionals because that's, well, just not professional. And ask yourselves how many times you hear that happen. I was doing a class with a group of 8 different healthcare professionals a number of years ago now, and it was all around interprofessional team care. And one of the students that was there was a medical student, and the medical student got buzzed to go. And that's fine, because we'd had a disagreement beforehand. He's in third year, and that's a hectic year for our students, and if he gets buzzed or she gets buzzed, they go. But do you know what happened when that student left the room? I give you one guess. I was so angry that I never shouted at a class before. I said, do you realize that if he was black or if he was disabled, you would never say that? How professional is it to talk pejoratively about another professional? Treat others as you would like them to treat yourself. Adam Smith, in The Theory of Moral Sentiments, describes something he calls sympathy, a notion that I really, really, really feel should be applied to collaboration. Adam Smith, the capacity to enter into the experience of someone else not like you was the fundamental principle around which just societies, as well as rich ones, evolved. It's so important that members of health and social care teams engender this sympathy about each other, to understand from the inside, and again, this was something that was mentioned earlier, from the inside, what is it that other person is doing? How do I relate to that? Mr. X died because of poor quality care, poor safety protocols, poor planning during his hospital stay. Linked intimately with each of these was poor communication between health social care professionals and poor communication between those who were supposedly providing care and his distraught family. 1 year following his death, his family were still mourning, and that was very clear in the complaint. No one had really tried to help them understand what had happened, which is why we heard the case. Today, I've tried to share with you that effective and efficient communication and collaboration across professional boundaries are fundamental to high-quality, safe, and effectively planned health and social care. I've also tried to share with you some of my own thoughts about how we might cross those boundaries. Interestingly, the paradox of real communication is, as we know, it's not about getting the best minds together, because supposedly we do that. It's about creating a new mindset. Thank you for your attention, all my relations.